understand your world. News.
Economy.
Trends.
Politics.
I want to help you know what's happening and why.
Global affairs.
Discovery.
Health. Family.
Truth.
The Bible.
This will make your life better.
The future.
This is Trouble Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review program. We're going to take a look back over the big news from this previous week, and I have here with me in the studio a few members of our writing staff for the Philadelphia Trumpet. I have with me here Robert Morley.
Hello.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in the UK.
Hello.
And the newest member of our team, our man watching the Middle East and Africa, Anthony Chibatiwe.
Greetings.
Our lead story today involves a strategy paper that China released on Tuesday of this week. Stephen Fleury covered this in his Trumpet Daily Radio program on Thursday. But this reveals China's direction in the time ahead and its military strategy. And I want to talk about what they said and some of the implications that this is going to have throughout Asia. This paper, it was the first policy document that the Chinese military has issued in 2 years. And there are a lot of things happening right now with China. It's demonstrating a lot of assertiveness in the South China Sea. On Tuesday, the same day that it released this paper, it announced that construction work had begun on two lighthouses in the Spratly Islands. And there's a whole lot of Chinese-built structures going up there that people are identifying in satellite photos. This is part of what Chinese leaders are calling a national rejuvenation as it moves to counter what it sees as American efforts to contain its rise. The headline in the New York Times on May 26th, China updating military strategy, puts focus on projecting naval power. This article talks about how not only do they want to continue to modernize their military in general, they want to develop a cyber military force, but they're really emphasizing improving their naval capabilities and projecting force far from China's coastline. And analysts are saying that's really the most striking facet of this paper. There's a quote here from a former army attaché in the United States Embassy in Beijing. This basically confirms everything that the vast majority of analysts have seen, developing the trends toward a greater maritime force, a stronger air force, and improved missile defenses. Just a whole lot of activity from China right now. So the United States has really demonstrated that it is not interested in stepping up and defending its interests in other part of the world. The U.S. is disarming. We're surrendering geographic areas all over the place. We've seen that, and we'll talk about it a little bit later. They sacrificed major portions of Iraq. The Islamic State took over Ramadi and Palmyra in Syria. China sees this. Russia sees this. They see that the United States isn't going to do anything about this, and so they feel like they can do what they want to do. And this is really what is fueling this rise in China's militarization. A few more headlines. Sydney Morning Herald, May 28th. China puts weapons on its new artificial islands. These islands that we spoke about just a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. is detecting motorized artillery pieces on one of the islands, and they're building up their military capability here and projecting their power into these islands in the South China Sea. Press TV on May 26th, general says Russia-China air power will be better than the U.S. in the future. There's also an article in this issue of the Trumpet Weekly that says U.S. is scared to death as China just secured a larger flow of gold as part of its plan to back the yuan with gold. We're going to talk more about that next week. But even economically, China is making its decisions based on a shrinking U.S. presence or a shrinking U.S. willpower to intervene. Just a few quotes from an article in The Economist in this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is from the May 30th edition of The Economist. On May 25th, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman called on America to end its provocative behavior. Global Times, a state-owned newspaper known for its hardline views, said war would be inevitable if America kept complaining about island building. So it's like China is considering complaining an act of war. They're not at all concerned that the United States is going to do anything about this. Despite America's increasingly public complaints, there has been no change in the frantic pace of China's reclamation efforts on several reefs. Another quote, America and China's neighbors worry that China may eventually declare an air defense identification zone over the South China Sea, requiring aircraft to identify themselves to the Chinese authorities before entering. So really, stepping up their claim on this territory and pushing the United States out and limiting America's ability to intervene in that part of the world, Chinese academics say that testing China's resolve could prove dangerous. Should America sail a naval ship close to one of the reefs, it, quote, may very well force Beijing to respond forcefully. This is a quote from a man at the China Center for Collaborative Studies of the South China Sea at Nanjing University. No Chinese leader, he says, wants to be seen as a chicken. So it's really remarkable developments in China, coming from China right now. Now, I'd like to open it up a little bit and just ask you all, what do you think about China's rise and its willingness to stick its neck out and to extend its power militarily?
I think the really significant ramifications of this can be seen among the smaller Asian nations. In Southeast Asia, you see a region-wide arms race. All across the area, nations are quickly ramping up their own military spending. And what you see forming here, in a sense, are two different camps. There's what I would call the defensive camp. These are countries like Japan and the Philippines that are very concerned about China's buildup, and so they're doing everything they can to build up their own forces and even collaborate with each other in order to counter China's rise. The second camp I would call the realist camp. And these are countries that are preparing themselves to be dominated by China or allied with it to some degree. You see Thailand and other nations, Kyrgyzstan, Myanmar to a degree, just sort of getting ready to throw their weight behind China. They see the U.S. fading. They see China rising, and they're prepared to abandon the sinking U.S. ship and to greet the new power of the region.
Another headline in this week's Trumpet Weekly, Southeast Asia maritime buildup accelerates, raising risks in disputed seas. This is from Reuters on May 25th. And again, Asian nations responding to China's military buildup. This says the 10 nations of Southeast Asia are expected to spend $58 billion on new military kit over the next 5 years, with naval procurement comprising a large chunk. Right now, annual defense spending in Southeast Asia is expected to be $42 billion this year. This is expected to rise, or projected to rise, to $52 billion within the next 5 years, according to IHS Jane's Defense Weekly. So they clearly see what's happening. And in a sense, we've seen this arms buildup happening, or really beginning in the Middle East in response to Iran's rise. And in a sense, you have a parallel situation developing in Asia as these other nations are trying to brace themselves or to counteract what they recognize clearly as China's militarization and even Russian aggression within Asia. The two heavyweights in Asia, Russia and China, both clearly on a power projection course, and these other nations having to respond and just deal with the reality of what Asia is going to look like in the time ahead with their increased power.
One thing that interests me about this is how much of that arms race is really being fueled by the withdrawal of America and U.S. foreign policy. America has made it very clear that it wants nations like Japan to rearm. It wants nations like Japan to pick up the slack for it and to take a greater role in confronting China. So we kind of see those two camps developing in Asia, but I think a lot of it is just because of America's unwillingness to go over there and do what needs to be done, fulfill its historical role in that region.
I think this is really a dramatic illustration of what we've been talking about for quite a long time now about the developing post-American world. The fact that America's presence is shrinking, that its willpower is under severe question, and that other nations are taking advantage of the void that it's leaving behind and stepping into that void. What China is doing is a perfect illustration of what we can expect to see in the time ahead because of that.
Well, this is what you see when empires collapse. I mean, this is what happens. The chaos we're seeing around this world, the destabilization, this posturing for power, the anarchy that's arising, that's what happens when you see nations withdrawing because of economic, geopolitical, whatever reasons. We are seeing America shrink on the world. And so we can expect to see a lot more of this going forward.
All of these stories that we've been talking about in relation to what's happening in China, they're in this week's edition of the Trumpet Weekly. I'd like to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. You can get it right in your email inbox. Our news team produces this very informative report every week. Gives you the most significant stories of the week. We try to collect the best commentary from the best sources, and it really does help you to understand your world. Just go online to thetrumpet.com to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. So while we're on the subject of Asia, I would like to return to our man watching Asia, Jeremiah Jacques. That's obviously a big story from Asia this week. I don't know if I left you anything else with the overview of what's happening in Asia, but do you have any overview stories for us?
Yes. Yeah, we have a few other smaller items included this week. There was an unsettling report that emerged just yesterday about North Korean nuclear experts traveling to Iran. This happened reportedly last month, but it just hit the headlines just yesterday. And so North Korea, we know, is a rogue state, probably the most dangerous nuclear nation there is. It's bent on the destruction of the U.S., never passes up an opportunity to talk about how it longs to destroy America. And this report comes at a time when Iran is supposed to be really proving its good intentions to the world. It's supposed to be proving to the world that its nuclear program is totally benign and not for military purposes of any kind. But instead, here you have Iran meeting with this country with an active nuclear weapons program and a record of really belligerent, threatening kind of behavior. So that was one Asia story. Another was on Tuesday, Russia and China were mentioned by a U.S. Air Force general who said they are closing the gap with the United States in terms of air power. This U.S. general says in 3 to 5 years, Russia and China will actually pass the U.S. up in terms of their air ability with their air force.
Yeah, we actually heard that clip on the Trumpet Daily this week from Mr. Stephen Fleury a couple of times. Really an extraordinary statement by that general.
Yes, that is extraordinary. We've led the world in all sorts of military power for decades and brought a lot of stability from that. But according to this general, those years are very much numbered.
So, Jeremiah, you have another big story from Asia this week you want to share with us.
Sure, yes. I think the big story for Asia is a new buildup of Russian troops on the border with Ukraine. Reuters reported that there are hundreds of pieces of weaponry, including mobile rocket launchers, tanks, artillery, and lots of soldiers to operate all of it. It's easy in a way to feel like this is not very noteworthy because it has happened several times in recent months without any cataclysmic consequences or repercussions. But there's something new this time, which I believe could mean that Russia is ready to launch sort of a phase two of its Ukraine invasion. And that is that the soldiers have removed signifying marks from their uniforms, from their tanks. They've taken license plates off. So they're sort of anonymous right now. There's nothing
that identifies them as Russian.
Right, right. Nothing could prove at this point that they are with the Russian military if they were discovered in another country across the border in Ukraine.
Now, was that not happening early on when, say, the Russians were taking over Crimea?
It was. This follows a pattern that was established in Crimea. Russia sent in troops without any insignia. They were nicknamed by the international community Little Green Men because of their anonymity, I guess. And with insignia removed, Moscow can deny any involvement. It can say, these are not our soldiers, these are not our forces, these are just Ukrainians who don't like the pro-Western government in Ukraine. And they want to fight against it so that Ukraine can be more aligned with Russia. It gives Moscow plausible deniability. And so a lot of analysts are saying that the fact that this troop buildup happening right now on the border of Ukraine, the fact that they're taking their signifying marks off, it means that an invasion probably is imminent, even if it's a small-scale one, a few troops here and there, a few little green men who are going to be sent across the border. Personally, I think that this could simply be Russia desensitizing the world, in a sense, to its military presence. I've put together an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly that sort of calls attention to the boy who cried wolf, that old Aesop's fable. I'm sure most people are familiar with it, but it's a shepherd boy who repeatedly tricks the neighbors in the village where he is into thinking that a wolf is attacking his flock. And when a wolf actually does appear, the neighbors are so accustomed to this shepherd boy's false alarms that they ignore his cries. And so then, without any interference from the neighbors, the wolf eats the sheep. And so in this new Trumpet Weekly article, we just remind readers of that tendency of human nature to grow desensitized to threats.
So we see another day, another headline of Russia's moving in here, but nothing really happens. They move in, they pull back, nothing really comes of it, and eventually people say, oh, it's no big deal.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, they're amassing troops on the border of another country? They did that last time and nothing came of it. Oh, they're removing their signifying marks this time from their uniforms and from their tanks? Well, they did that last time and nothing came of it either. And so, you know, there's no wolf there. There's no bear, it may be in this case. but I think it's a really important story because it does show that even if this is not a prelude to invasion, then it is just desensitizing all of us to the threat that is still looming there.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour on KPCG 101.3 FM from Edmond, Oklahoma. This is our Week in Review program. Looking back over the big headlines from this past week, so Europe is obviously strongly concerned about what's happening in Ukraine and the way that Russia is aggressively pushing in that area. So I want to turn now to Europe. Let's talk to Richard Palmer in the UK. Hello, Richard. What were some of the important items that came out of Europe this week?
Hi. Well, exactly a week ago, we had Ireland voting on whether or not to accept homosexual marriage. And then the results for that vote came out on Saturday. So they overwhelmingly accepted homosexual marriage. And this is the first time that any country has legalized same-sex marriage by popular vote. And so this fact, plus the fact that Ireland is such a staunchly Catholic country, adds a lot of momentum to the same-sex marriage movement. And then this week, we've also seen the Catholic Church respond to that. And some in the Catholic Church have said, you know, this is a catastrophe, this is a disaster. Other leading figures in the Catholic Church have embraced it and said, actually, this is a very good thing. So there's a clear split in the Catholic Church, and that's something that's becoming much clearer as we see movements like this push to homosexual marriage, and that's something the Catholic Church is going to have to deal with in the near future. Then this week, the UK began upped its big EU reform push. Mr. Cameron wants to renegotiate Britain's membership of the EU and get kind of a weaker membership of the European Union and then put that to the people in a vote. And so the legislation for that vote was laid out in the Queen's speech at the opening of Parliament on Wednesday. Then on Thursday, Mr. Cameron was in France. Today he's in Germany and he's traveling around the EU talking to all the EU leaders about Britain's place in the EU. And then the final thing I'll just mention quickly is the G7 group of nations met in Dresden this week with Germany at the helm. And there they talked a lot about Greece. And we've had a few rumors coming out of that about Greece and whether Greece is going to go bust or not. But nothing exactly clear from that meeting.
Richard, in this week's Trumpet Weekly, we have an article in here from Business Insider dated May 27th. The title is Angela Merkel's Fear of Russia Could Turn Her into Greece's Unlikely Guardian. And having just spoken about the Russian troop buildup on Ukraine, so maybe you could just fill us in on what's happening and how Europe is responding, and particularly Merkel is responding to what she's seeing from Russia.
Yeah, this article raises an aspect of the Greek economic crisis that isn't really talked about enough. So a lot of commentators talk about it purely in economic terms, but this article raises the fact of European security that we heard about in the last news item about the troop buildups. So right now, Europe faces two major security threats. And the second we're also going to talk about, I think, a bit later, in that there's an increasingly aggressive and unpredictable Russia to the east, and then there's a rising tide of radical Islam to Europe's south and southeast. And Greece plays a very central role in both of these threats. And so because of Greece's poor economy, it's become very easy over the past few years to think of Greece as kind of a poor, unimportant nation on the periphery of Europe. But that's not the case at all, and this article really brings that out. Culturally and geographically, it is in a vital position within Europe and within the Eurozone. So on the one hand, Greece's influence extends deep into the Balkans, and securing Greece is essential for securing the Balkans as an area, if not in the European Union, then very strongly under European influence. And it's the linchpin for that whole region. But as this article brings out, a lot of the Balkan region and a lot of Greece has very strong historic and cultural links to Russia. So Greece and Serbia are Orthodox Christian states, as is Russia. And historically, Russia has been kind of the patron and supporter of these nations against the nations of Central Europe. And so if Greece is completely booted out of the EU or leaves the euro in bitterness and anger, then it could drift into Russia's orbit. And you could have a repeat of that almost pre-World War I situation where that whole region shifts over to Russia. And Russia could hold out the carrot of loans and financial aid to help that along, which would be expensive for Russia, but it's enough of a possibility to worry EU leaders. And so this would have major implications at a time where Russia is behaving very aggressively, major implications for Europe's security. But then you also have the Middle East, and Greece has incredibly strong ties with Cyprus. So the island is split into Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots, and it's the Greek Cypriot part that's part of the EU. And there have been several attempts to make Greek Cyprus part of Greece itself. So they have deep influence there. If the EU is going to project power into the Middle East, they need Cyprus. So German naval vessels patrolling the Lebanese coast at the moment have their home base in Cyprus. And we've written a fair bit on the Trumpet about how important of a base it is. And so as Europe sees the Middle East becoming more unstable, they see America stepping back, they've got to be thinking, we might have to get involved soon. And they'll need Cyprus to do that. And Greece is absolutely essential for keeping Cyprus on side. If Greece leaves and if Greece goes over to the Russian camp, Cyprus will follow too. And so then we see Cyprus flirting with Russia as well. And we've written a few bits about that, about Cyprus, Russia establishing naval bases there or talking about that. And so these represent a major, major concern for Europe.
This is really interesting. It's like Europe is in a really tight spot here, caught on one hand with trying to just get a grip on its situation financially, economically, dealing with Greece and the problems that are happening down there, and trying to rescue its currency and trying to just bring its economic affairs under control. Whereas if it punishes Greece or it excludes Greece, then all of a sudden you have several security implications that are really problematic. I mean, it's really in a catch-22 here, isn't it?
Right. And I think what it means is that going forward, Germany cannot play hardball with both Greece and Russia at the same time. And I think it will have to conciliate either one or the other. So they could talk to the Russians and get some kind of agreement that Russia is not going to court Greece and Cyprus, and that if Germany really clamps down on Greece, then the Russians aren't going to support them. And if they get that agreement from Russia and they trust it, then they could probably start piling on the pressure on Greece and still be fairly confident that it's not going to leave the European orbit. Or they could console Greece and essentially pay Greece off. And that doesn't necessarily mean keeping Greece in the euro, but it means making sure that there's no kind of catastrophic euro exit and that Greece doesn't suffer much further from this.
Do you have any kind of sense of where you think this might go based on what we understand about biblical prophecy?
Well, personally, I think they would work with Russia. I think it could go the other way. But I do think that Greece will end up still being a core part of the EU. And we've talked about the EU whittling down to a core group of nations. And I think just strategically and culturally and historically, Greece's place in the EU means that they'll probably be part of that core. But I think Germany will probably work with Russia a bit on this. I think Greece has made all of these demands of the EU. And if they get them, then you're going to get a whole bunch of other nations making the same demands. And the EU just can't afford to give in to that. They couldn't afford to give these demands to all these other nations. And so for the EU to survive, I think they do really need to beat Greece into submission to a certain extent. And I think in the longer term, Russia is certainly an existential threat to the EU. But in the short term, I think Greece has the bigger potential to destroy the European project. And so I think that makes the compromise with Russia in the short term a more likely outcome.
Thank you very much, Richard. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. You can go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. We're going to turn our attention now to the Middle East and to our man watching that part of the world, Anthony Chibadewe. Anthony, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to just start talking about the cover story of this week's Trumpet Weekly. We've talked a lot about Asia and what's happening in Europe, but really the cover story of this week's Trumpet Weekly is a Middle Eastern story. If you could just tell us what happened this week that was such big news in the Middle East.
Well, the title of this article is Palmyra, a milestone in the Islamic State war. And this article is talking about the fall of the city of Palmyra, which is an ancient city in central Syria, which recently fell to the Islamic State terrorists in Syria. And you know they've been getting a lot of territory both in Iraq and in Syria. And this is perhaps their biggest victory yet. With the capture of this city, they are gaining 50% of the entire territory of Syria. That's about 35,000 square miles that they just recently added to the territory under their control. And just some fascinating facts about Palmyra is that name is a Greek name, and it's actually found in the Bible, but under its Aramaic name in 2 Chronicles, it was under the control of King Solomon's empire. And over the years, Palmyra has come under the control of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, the Ottoman Empire. It's very symbolic. It's a World Heritage Site. So the Islamic State capturing this city attracts a lot of attention to it, which is exactly what it's been trying to do. So a lot of the media is going to be focusing on it, and it's a big blow, really, to Syria, and it's a big blow to Iran, which sponsors the Syrian regime.
This article brings out the fact that Bashar Assad has really been working to try to hold on to this key city, and the fact that Islamic State was able to take it over really puts his regime under threat, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Like I said, it's at the very center of Syria, so that's pretty significant. What I also think is significant is that it actually makes a connection between Syria and Iraq. It connects Palmyra and Ramadi in Iraq. And essentially, that whole region between those two cities now belongs to the Islamic State. So it has a lot of free territory that it can easily move arms and essentially gain more control of that region.
So how does Iran respond to this? This is something it's been trying to avoid, and it's really done so much to prop up the Assad regime to try to retain its alliance with Syria, a key ally, and really, say, even geographically, its link to Hezbollah in Lebanon. If the Islamic State is making these kinds of gains in Syria and really threatening the Assad regime, how does Iran respond to this?
Ramadi, which is the city in Iraq, which fell about in mid-May, about three or so weeks ago, that was a big blow again to the Iranians. Iranian militants are stationed in Iraq, try to defend Iraq from some of these rebels. So we had Ramadi falling, and now we have Palmyra falling in Syria. So really, that puts a lot of strain on the Iranians trying to retain this territory.
So both in Syria and Iraq, it's almost like two of its main interests in the region, and it's under assault in both of them. It's almost like it has to choose, doesn't it?
It has to choose. Iraq is obviously geographically closer to Iran, and Iran is really, really weak right now. In fact, since the fall of Ramadi, the U.S. Defense Secretary, Ashton Carter, said that the Iraqi forces just showed no will to fight, absolutely no will to fight. But we know that the Iranians are stationed in Iraq, and they do have that will to fight. And we know that they're going to pick up the slack of the Iraqi military. Syria might become a little more complicated for the Iranians right now because there's so much against Assad's regime. It's the Islamic State, and it's covering a lot of ground there. And the United States is also against Assad's regime. We have a lot of moderate Arab nations that are against the Assad regime. We have a bunch of other rebels, Al-Qaeda-linked rebels that are against Assad's regime. So really, it's going to be a lot more difficult for Iran to try to help Assad in Syria, but it cannot afford to lose Iraq.
I think this article makes a good point that basically Assad remaining in power is kind of key to Iran's position, being able to maintain its position within Syria, whereas its leverage over Iraq is more far-reaching. It's far more entrenched in that country. There's no single political leader that is holding up Iran's interests there the way that Assad is in Syria. So we could see a pretty radical shift very quickly in Syria. If Assad falls, then suddenly the picture is very different over there, whereas it's not the case in Iraq. Stephen Fleury was talking about this in the Trumpet Daily even this morning, about just how both the loosening of Iran's grip in Syria and the strengthening of its grip in Iraq, which are both likely outcomes of this push by Islamic State, both fit into scenarios that we've been talking about for a long time based on biblical prophecy, the severing of the alliance between Iran and Syria and the strengthening of the alliance between Iran and Iraq. So pretty interesting story, major development this last week in Syria, and something that we really need to keep an eye on, mostly in terms of Iran's response to what's happening in both of those places. You are listening to Trumpet Hour on KPCG 101.3 FM from Edmond, Oklahoma. This is our Week in Review program, and we're going to look finally at news in America. We're going to talk to Robert Morley here. Robert, what is the important news in your view this past week?
Lots of news, lots of important articles. One item is titled "The Ruins of Empire in the Middle East." This is an article from Foreign Policy by Dr. Kaplan, a well-known geopolitical analyst. In this article, he's arguing that the collapse of empires has always been a messy business, and that America pulling out of the Middle East is going to be messy. He says that American power is waning, which is why America is trying to come to terms with Iran the way it is, why it is jumping over barrels to accommodate Iran, which is a rising power. Another article you'll find in the Trumpet Weekly is HSBC, that bank fears world recession with no lifeboats left. And this is an article from The Telegraph. Ambrose Evans Pritchard wrote it. He's probably one of the better economic writers out there. He makes a point in that article that each of the past four U.S. recoveries has been weaker than the last one. So every time we have these bubbles, the recovery has become weaker and weaker. And he says now that global authorities face awful choices and that if the economy doesn't get better, authorities are going to have to resort to what he calls helicopter money, which is basically printing money and dropping it from helicopters, or printing money from nothing at the central banks and giving the money to people to spend. So analysts out there seeing that the global economy is more shaky than ever. Lastly, there's another article in there, Boring to Replenish Depleted Pensions. This is a New York Times article, May 27th, and it's highlighting the fact that states across America are grabbing pages out of Chicago's playbook. Chicago bankrupt, broke Chicago, and they're borrowing money to prop up their pension plans, and how this is a recipe for disaster, a multi-trillion dollar recipe for disaster. So lots of good stories in the Trump Weekly this week. Check it out.
What's your top story from America this week?
Top story comes out of California this week. It's the Los Angeles Times piece. It's titled, Los Angeles Labor Leaders Seek Minimum Wage Exemption for Firms with Union Workers. So here we have unions in California who have been pushing hard, bringing all kinds of political pressure and money pressure, monetary pressure on politicians to get them to pass this increase in the minimum wage in California. And now, as it's been passed, they're seeking a last-minute exemption for the minimum wage increase for union members, of all things. So here they're saying the minimum wage is good for America. We need to raise it to alleviate poverty. We need to raise it to bring back our economy, help our economy recover. Yet we don't want our union members to have to be bound by these wage increases. So it seems pretty hypocritical and kind of ironic to me, but I think it's, you know, we're seeing a couple of things going on here. First, we're seeing that the minimum wage issue really is just about politics and power in California. Unions, they want to force people into their unions. They want to force businesses to unionize. They can't make that argument economically that it's good for businesses. So they're trying to use the power of the state to force businesses. If they can get this exemption that says, okay, businesses that have a union don't have to pay minimum wage, they can pay less, they think, okay, this is going to be allow us to get more unions into California. So of course the unions want all the money that's going to come out of these union dues. And then there's the city councilors. If you look at the people who voted for the increase in minimum wage, the 14 councilors who voted, they got something like 180 grand from unions in campaign promises. So you're having this, you know, this unholy alliance between unions and politicians. But that kind of brings us to, you know, the second thing that's going on there. And that's, I think some union members within these unions might actually see that this could cost them their jobs. If you think about this, the minimum wage in Los Angeles was $10.75. Now, the new law, it's $15. That's almost a 50% raise in the minimum wage. There's going to be economic consequences from dramatically for raising the cost of doing business in California. And I think some members look at this and say, well, maybe this might actually cost me my job. So I think some of the unions might be getting some pressures from some of their members that this might not be such a good thing.
Lots of economic evidence of the downside of mandatory minimum wage laws. If you raise the price of having an employee, you're either going to have to raise the price of your goods or you're going to have to lay some people off. Just from an economic standpoint, it just doesn't work.
It's economics 101, isn't it? Anybody who's taken your basic introductory college course in economics knows that if you want less of something, make it more expensive, right? I mean, that's what the minimum wage, raising the minimum wage law does. You want less employment? Let's make it more expensive. Let's make it harder to employ people. Let's make it harder for businesses to go out and hire someone. And that's what this job has done.
And it's really the poorest people who are impacted the most. The people who could get a job at a very low wage, maybe they don't have the skill to warrant $15 an hour to an employer. They're not worth that to an employer, but maybe they're worth $7 an hour. Basically, a law like this says, no, we're not going to hire you. Basically, an employer says, I can't afford to pay anybody to do what you're capable of doing.
I think that's really the sad part, because unions and their supporters really market these minimum wage laws as, you know, this is a caring, loving,
compassionate for the poor.
Right, compassionate, the fair thing to do. We need to, you know, these greedy business owners need to be forced to share their wealth and be more...
Pay people a living wage.
Right, pay people a living wage. But if you look at what it actually does, yeah, the people who actually keep their jobs get paid more initially until inflation wipes out a lot of those gains. But think of all the other people that lose their jobs. And I think that's a great point you make, because there was an article in a National Review just less than a month back. They went in and they interviewed some business owners in San Francisco, because San Francisco had recently raised their minimum wage to $15 per hour. And in San Francisco, 77% of voters voted to raise the minimum wage. But now the impacts are starting to hit the city. And they went and interviewed this owner of a comic book store. It's kind of this, it was an iconic store in San Francisco. He employed four or five people. And he said how he voted for it because it was basically the good thing to do. And now, a year later, as he's sitting down and doing the math, he says, I didn't realize it was going to cost me $80,000 a year more. My business doesn't function at $80,000 or more in expenses. I can't do that much more revenue. I'm going to have to lay people off. I'm going to have to cut back. I might be out of business. And there's hundreds of businesses in San Francisco that are in the same situation, and those effects are starting to be seen.
So it doesn't shouldn't surprise any of us that the unions would say, you know, we'd like to implement these rules, but we're not going to abide by them ourselves.
Well, absolutely. Well, look what happened to Detroit. Look what the unions did to Detroit. If you want a picture of the future of California carried to the extreme, take a look at Detroit, one of the most prosperous cities in America, provided all kinds of high standards of livings for people, and union policies brought down that great city, and now we're going to see similar things happening in California.
Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All of the stories that we're talking about here can be found in this week's edition. We're going to conclude with our lightning round. We're going to give each man a chance to talk about the second most important item in his region, or what he thinks is second most important from this edition of The Trumpet Weekly. We'll start with Jeremiah.
The second most important story for Asia was that China has not forgotten about Taiwan. The leadership in Beijing have long said that Taiwan is not an independent nation, but it's just a part of China. And at the beginning of the show, you mentioned the paper that Beijing released, a strategy paper about China's military goals. And that paper really shows that China still has its eyes on Taiwan. These days in the headlines, most of what you see regarding China's rise and increasing belligerence is about what they're doing in the South China Sea, making the new islands there, militarizing those islands and whatnot. But this new strategy paper shows that assimilating Taiwan remains an even higher priority for China than all of that South China Sea buildup. The Trumpet has long said that Taiwan will become a part of China. Back in 1998, Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote an article. I'll just read one quote from that. It says, "How could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? It is going to happen for one reason, because of a pitifully weak-willed America." So if this white paper is a reliable indication, then 2015 could be a really big year for that trend.
Well, I'm going to give my second most important item, and that was this interview that President Barack Obama gave with Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic. There's a lot in this interview that I thought was really interesting, and we might have to just write up more about this next week. But I just thought it was interesting. The president actually, Jeffrey Goldberg was asking him about how do you reconcile the fact that you have this Iranian regime that is steeped in venomous anti-Semitism with the president's claims that, well, it's a practical, it's responsive to incentive, it shows signs of rationality. How do you reconcile these two things? And the president actually said, well, with respect to trying to use anti-Semitic rhetoric as an organizing tool, he said basically that Iran is just using that as an organizing tool, that it doesn't actually believe in anti-Semitism. It only pursues hate-based policies where the costs are low. He said, maintaining power, having some semblance of legitimacy inside their country, these are the larger goals within Iran, and getting out of the deep economic rut that we've put them in. And the president actually said, well, you know, there are deep strains of anti-Semitism in this country, not to mention Europe, as if comparing what's happening, the attitudes within the United States and within Europe can possibly even compare with what you hear coming out of Iran. And it's like he can't even acknowledge the very likely explanation or the obvious explanation that Iran actually believes what it says about the Jews and that it is willing to do whatever it can, whatever it needs to, and pay whatever price in order to live out and to carry out policies based on that view. But hopefully we'll have more coming out about that very interesting article, that interview that Jeffrey Goldberg published last week. Next, we're going to go to Richard.
The Times reported today that Britain is going to cut its defense spending by £1 billion, or it works out to be about $1.5 billion. And this represents a 2.5% cut in defense spending. But when considering this news, it's important to remember that Britain has already cut its defense by about 8 or 9% over the last 5 years. And Mr. Stephen Flayo, on his program earlier in the week, he was quoting from an article in the Washington Post called Britain Resigns as a World Power, which talks about the fact that with the cuts we've already had, Britain's army is on course to be about the same size as the New York Police Department. They quoted the International Institute for Strategic Studies saying that the cuts already have led to a 20 or 30% reduction in Britain's military capacity. So Britain's military is already struggling, and now they're piling extra cuts on top of all of these cuts that already have had a really catastrophic impact on Britain's military. And at the same time, Britain's Conservative government has promised to spend an extra £8 billion a year on healthcare. So they're spending an extra £8 billion on healthcare while cutting £1 billion from defense. It's going to have a major impact on Britain's military. And it just shows, as this Washington Post article talked about, a very parochial and inward-looking worldview that we see in Britain today.
Okay, Anthony Chibatawe, your second most important item from the Middle East this week.
Commentary magazine had an article on Tuesday titled, America Looked the Other Way While Iran Started a War in Yemen. And it's talking about how essentially the United States just turned aside and just allowed Iran to sponsor the Houthi rebels and empower the Houthi rebels. It says here that the Houthi rebels that Iran supported were suspected of having military and diplomatic links to Iran long before they captured the capital city of Sana'a last year. And the Financial Times had another article last week just talking about how even when the United States was trying to make overtures to these rebels, these Shiite rebels in Yemen, even while they were doing all of that, Iran was covertly shipping tons, 15,000 metric tons of arms to these rebels. Really, it really goes at the heart and core of the Obama administration's foreign policy in the Middle East, where they look at the non-state Sunni military groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. They look at them as more menacing than state sponsors, state actors like Iran. But then, you know, people talk about the lesser of two evils, choosing the lesser of two evils, and essentially that's what the United States is doing. The only problem is that they're choosing the wrong evil there, or at least they're getting it wrong as to who is the most menacing player in the Middle East, and in this case, it is Iran.
Thank you, Anthony. And Robert Morley, to conclude, your second most important item.
The second most important news item is on Baltimore and how the violence in Baltimore is just escalating. This past month was the worst month in 15 years for Baltimore. The number of arrests in that city has plunged, I think, by half of what it was averaging before Freddie Gray was arrested. And now we're starting to see in that city the effects of the race issues in America and how we have handled those issues. The police are very afraid to come into the city and do their jobs. The article talks about, that's in the Trumpet Weekly, talks about how when officers arrive on site, they get surrounded by mobs because the people feel empowered that it's now they're in control. It's not the police officers. The article talks about how The police officers also don't want to come into these areas because they feel like they're going to be prosecuted by the Justice Department, made examples of. They're afraid that the Justice Department is looking for any little thing to pin on them as an example of white racism against black people. So now we have a city that's essentially descending into lawlessness. And what we are seeing in that city is the result of what happens when law is removed. When there's nobody in the city to maintain law and order, what happens? And this is what the people of Baltimore said they wanted. The police were militant. They're too tough on them. We need to get the police out of the city. And look what happens. There's examples that an article in the Trump Weekly goes through and tells about people having to barricade themselves in their houses because there's people walking up and down the streets with guns. There's drug dealers on the street, people with alcohol. The city's out of control because the police aren't there. And the very same people who wanted the police gone are now saying, we want them back. This was an article also, this topic was something that that Stephen Fleury covered in the Trumpet Daily program. And I'd encourage you to go, and anybody who's out there, to go and take a look and listen to that program. You can find it on the Trumpet website.
Thank you, Robert. You've been listening to Joel Hilliker and Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All of these stories are in there. We have links to the relevant Trumpet articles that give you more explanation. You can even get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. Receive 10 issues of this high-quality news magazine every year at no cost to you. Send us your thoughts, send us your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook or Google+ by searching Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, Anthony Chibadirwe. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Winston Churchill. For a nation to try to tax itself into prosperity is like a man standing in a bucket and trying to lift himself up by the handle. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.